The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from NPR, The Economist, Religion News Service, and the Associated Press News. First of all, an article from NPR, published on February 9 and written by Juliana Kim. Charges dropped against Ohio pastor who housed homeless people at his church. The city of Bryan, Ohio, has dropped all charges against a local pastor who was allowing homeless people to sleep inside his church without the city's permission. Bryan is my home. I am eager to continue to serve God, my community, and the people I love, Pastor Chris Avell said in a statement. Avell had faced 18 zoning code violations for turning his church, Dad's Place, into a quasi-homeless shelter. Those violations were punishable by fines up to 6 months in prison or both. In January, Dad's Place filed a federal suit against the city on the grounds of religious discrimination. The church argued that providing food and shelter was a form of religious expression, and therefore its ministry is protected by the Constitution. Earlier this week, Bryan, a city of about 8,600 people located about an hour west of Toledo, dismissed the case against Avell. The church plans to continue to offer temporary lodging to those in need, but agreed to work with the city to meet safety codes, according to Dyes. The city of Bryan appreciates the willingness of Dad's Place to work with the city to resolve the parties' differences amicably and to ensure that the services provided by Dad's Place are delivered in a safe manner, Mayor Carrie Schlade said in a statement. Dad's Place began to offer overnight stays last March, partly in response to the housing shortage in Bryan, according to Jeremy Dyes, who represented Avell. Dyes is an attorney with First Liberty Institute, a law firm focused on religious liberty cases. About 8 people on average would stay at the church, as well as 2 church volunteers, Dyes said. The lodging has been intended for temporary or emergency purposes only. The city said that last spring, police began to receive an influx of calls over safety concerns at Dad's Place, including larceny, harassment, and disturbing the peace. Soon, the church also faced zoning code violations because it is in a district that prohibits residential use on the first floor of any building. The city said it warned Avell of the zoning laws in November, but the church continued its operations. Last fall, Bryan officials launched a series of building inspections, which found multiple fire code violations, including limited ventilation and inadequate exit areas. The city said it ultimately pursued criminal charges against Avell because the church was putting people at risk by housing them in a building not up to code. But according to Dyes, the building was simply old, and the church worked tirelessly to resolve the violations. Why is it that the city is currently upset about these code violations? Dyes told NPR in January. They're concerned about the safety because they want to cause an issue that would be a problem for the church and create an opportunity for the city to drive the church out. Avell pleaded not guilty in January. His trial was scheduled to begin Friday. His suit against the city and its officials are ongoing, according to Dyes. A hearing is set for March the 4th. Now an article published by the Associated Press on February 20 and written by Brian P.D. Hannon. New York Archdiocese denounces transgender activist funeral. The funeral of a renowned transgender activist in a New York City cathedral elicited a denunciation of the event by a senior church official, who called the mass a scandal within one of the preeminent houses of worship in U.S. Catholicism. The Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York condemned the funeral of Cecilia Gentile, which was held in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan and drew a large audience on February 15. Gentile was known as a leading advocate for other transgender people, as well as sex workers and people with HIV. A post on her Instagram account announced her death on February 6 at age 52. In a written statement released Saturday, the Reverend Enrique Salvo, pastor of St. Patrick's, thanked those who share our outrage over the scandalous behavior at the funeral. The cathedral only knew that family and friends were requesting a funeral mass for a Catholic and had no idea our welcome and prayer would be degraded in such a sacrilegious and deceptive way, Salvo said. Videos of Gentile's funeral show an estimated audience of more than 1,000 celebrants, including transgender people and other friends, and supporters chanting her name, applauding, singing, and offering praise of her stature as a leading light of the city's LGBTQ+ community. During one eulogy that was widely circulated on social media, Gentile was celebrated as Saint Cecilia, the mother of all whores. Salvo called the behavior at the mass a scandal and a potent reminder of how much we need the prayer, reparation, repentance, grace, and mercy to which this holy season of Lent invites us. In a statement, Gentile's family denied that the church had been deceived and said the gathering brought precious life and radical joy to the cathedral in historic defiance of the church's hypocrisy and anti-trans hatred. The only deception present at St. Patrick's Cathedral is that it claims to be a welcoming place for all, the family said. A former sex worker who suffered addiction and was jailed at Rikers Island, Gentile became a transgender health program coordinator, a nonprofit policy director for an established gay men's health organization, GMHC, and a lobbyist for health equality and anti-discrimination legislation, among other advocacy work. Gentile founded the COIN Clinic, short for Cecilia's Occupational Inclusion Network, a free health program for sex workers, through the Callan Lord Community Health Organization in New York. New York's LGBTQ+ community has lost a champion in trans icon Cecilia Gentile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul posted on X. Gentile acted in the FX television series Pose about the underground ballroom dance scene in the 1980s and 1990s. She also performed two one-woman stage shows. I am an atheist, but I am always asking God for things, Gentile said in Red Ink, her autobiographical show touching on topics including her childhood in Argentina and lack of religious faith. St. Patrick's Cathedral, a Manhattan architectural and tourist landmark, has been the site of funerals for numerous prominent New Yorkers, including Senator Robert F. Kennedy, Babe Ruth, and emergency responders who died in the September 11 terrorist attack. Conservative group Catholic Vote condemned fellow Pose actor Billy Porter, whose singing performance during the funeral was characterized by the group as a mockery of the Our Father prayer. This is just unbelievable and sick, Catholic Vote said on X. In a statement before the song, Porter called Gentile a leader among an entire community of people who transformed my life forever. Grief is singular. It's individual. Please know that however you grieve is what's right, Porter said. There's no right or wrong way to grieve, but just make sure that you do. You allow yourself to do that so that we can get to the other side of something that feels a little bit like grace. Now, an article published on January 27 and The Economist, entitled Russia's Plan to Seduce Christians. On a hillside in Kisii, western Kenya, the congregation of St. Peter's Church convened for a special mass on January 7. In the Russian calendar, today is Christmas Day, said Hezekiah Johnson Okora, the priest. To mark the occasion, Mr. Otora picked four girls from the 70-odd worshipers and promised to pay their school fees for the coming year. Mr. Otora is one of scores of African priests who have switched to Russia's branch of Orthodox Christianity as the fallout from the Ukraine war has unexpected consequences across the world. He joined the Patriarchal Exarchate of Africa, which claims jurisdiction over more than 200 parishes in 25 African countries and plans to build schools, hospitals, and cathedrals, including a huge spiritual center opposite the presidential palace in Uganda. One possible reason for the Russian Church's African adventure is to do down the Patriarchate of Alexandria, a branch of the Greek Orthodox Church. The Russian Orthodox Church considers all Ukrainian Orthodox churches to be under its own authority. But in 2019, the Greek Orthodox Patriarchs of Constantinople and then Alexandria recognized the independence of the newly formed Orthodox Church of Ukraine. Patriarch Kirill, the Russian Church's head, broke off relations with Alexandria and Constantinople, damning their support for Ukrainian schismatics. In revenge, the Russians are now muscling in on the Greek Orthodox Church, which claims exclusive jurisdiction over Africa and accuses the Russian Church of trying to lure its priests away with money. They want to humiliate us because of our connection with Ukraine, says Archbishop Makarios of Nairobi. Most of the Russian Church's priests in Africa, including Mr. Otara, are Greek-trained clerics who have switched teams. In Kenya alone, at least 90 have defected, nearly half the total number of African priests whose loyalty the Russian Church now claims to command. Asked why he joined the Russians, Mr. Otara cites the schism in Ukraine. He does not deny, however, that the move also brought some rather worldly benefits. They have doubled his salary, paid for his son to study nursing in Moscow, and contributed money to the orphanage he also runs. Russia may have more than ecclesiastical goals in mind. Punishing the Alexandrian Patriarchate was just an excuse, says Cyril Hovorin, a Ukrainian theologian. He believes the Russian Church waded into Africa to spread propaganda and stoke hostility toward the West. The idea is less risible than it may seem at first. The Russian Church's favorite subject, traditional values, and how the decadent West wants to pervert them, aligns with conservative religious views in Africa, where clerics tend to oppose homosexuality. Yet, the Russian foray seems half-hearted and poorly financed. Most of its churches are shacks, like the one in Mr. Otaro's parish. It appears to have built no schools or hospitals. Even evidence of a well-organized propaganda campaign is thin on the ground. The Russians might pay more, but many priests are still too busy making ends meet to rail against the West. I normally do some side hustling, explains one of the church's priests in western Kenya, who runs a shop in his spare time. It's for our survival and for my children. Many of the Russian church's problems can be blamed on erratic leadership. Leonid Gorbachev, a former bishop of Klin, was initially appointed to run the African outpost. Mr. Hovorin, who knew himself as a student in Athens during the early 2000s, says he was always more interested in Russian military canons than the canons of the church. Mr. Gorbachev later became a vocal supporter of Yevhen Prigozhin, the late leader of the Wagner mercenary group. He was sacked shortly after Prigozhin's failed mutiny last summer. The defenestration has thrown Russia's African church into disarray. Its priests say they are facing funding cuts. Projects have been put on hold. Mr. Hovarin believes the enterprise is winding down. Even if that is wishful thinking, Russia's holy adventure looks more quixotic than menacing. Now an opinion piece published by the Religion News Service on February 8 and written by Bob Smetana. I am not going to hate you. Not long ago, I stood in my front yard and did something I'd been procrastinating about for months. I put up a yard sign. It's a simple sign. A heart decorated with stars and stripes sits on a background above five simple words. Hate has no home here. The message is repeated in five other languages: Urdu, Korean, Hebrew, Spanish, and Arabic. It's a message so simple a child can understand it. In fact, the message on the sign was coined by an elementary school student from the north side of Chicago, where all those languages are spoken. The signs, designed by a friend who is one of the student's neighbors, went viral in 2017 during the protest over what became known as the Muslim ban, an executive order barring entry to immigrants from a number of countries, most with Muslim majorities. The ban was seen as an attack on immigrants and a sign of the greater polarization in the country, where we define ourselves more and more by who we hate. We had a similar sign in front of our place in Tennessee, in part because my friend designed them. When we moved a few years ago, the sign got lost. It took me a while to order a new one. Then the new sign sat unopened for more than a year in its package on a shelf in my office. Why? Because I was concerned about living up to the words on the sign, which I have begun to read differently over the past few years. To put up that sign meant claiming that hate has no home, not just in my neighborhood, but in my own home and in my own heart. It's one thing to reject policies or actions that are hateful. It is another thing to altogether refrain from hating the people behind those policies or actions, or to keep hating from driving my decisions, especially in a time when we Americans love to hate each other. Hate makes so many things easier. No more trying to understand complex issues or attempting to see the world through someone else's eyes or doing the hard work of understanding other people and their points of view. Things become simple. I am good and the people I don't like are evil. Anything I do that harms or dismisses or stands in the way of those evildoers is justified. Let me be clear. There are trivial things I love to hate, like the New York Yankees. I was born and raised a Boston Red Sox fan. Or the fact that I can no longer get a chocolate coconut donut at Dunkin' Donuts. There are more serious things we should hate: cancer, or the harm done by sex abuse in the church and church leaders, sometimes callous disregard. We should hate intentional and systemic injustice. But it is all too easy to go from hating things to hating people. Hate makes us feel righteous, wrote social psychologists Kurt Gray and Will Blakely in an essay called They Hate Me. It gives us license to feel good being cruel to others. This righteous cruelty drives much of our political discourse today. There are whole industries of people who sow conflict and distrust for profit, or worse, for the dopamine hits that come along with going viral on social media, where hate has become our favorite cash crop. One of the wisest parables I know comes not from the Bible or other book of wisdom, but from an episode of Star Trek called The Day of the Dove, which debuted in November 1968. In this episode, the crew members of the Enterprise find themselves locked in a battle for survival against their fierce rivals, the Klingons. The Klingons believe the crew of the Enterprise attacked without warning. The crew members of the Enterprise thought they were betrayed while on a mission of mercy. As the fight rages on, each side becomes more convinced of the righteousness of its cause and begins to accuse its enemies of atrocities that never really happened. It turns out they are all being deceived by an alien who feeds conflict and who likes nothing more than to feast on hatred, real or imagined. And when the two crews discover the deception that they are being used, they lay down their weapons. In doing so, they banish the alien from their presence. "Only a fool fights in a burning house," one of the Klingons says, in explaining why he gave up hate in that moment. "I fear that in these present days, many of us are fools fighting in a burning house. And I do not wish to be a fool anymore." Now, an excerpt from an article published in The Economist on January 27, entitled "The Comeback of Notre Dame." On an icy January morning, perched at a dizzying height of nearly 100 meters above the ground, specialist roofers are covering the rebuilt oak spire of Notre Dame Cathedral with layers of lead sheeting. Working on platforms reached by a perilous flight of narrow stairs that cling to the soaring spire, they are putting the final touches on a 1,000-piece solid oak structure that will soon restore the cathedral's familiar silhouette. Designed in 1859 by Eugène Viollet-le-Duc, an architect, and felled by the devastating fire of 2019, the new flesh remains hidden behind dense scaffolding. But 5 years after the world watched aghast as the Gothic cathedral roof was devoured by flames, the project to rebuild Notre Dame is astonishingly on schedule. The cathedral doors are due to reopen in December. The rebuilding of Notre Dame is one of the most complex and ambitious reconstruction projects that France has ever undertaken on a historic monument. Fire engulfed the entire wooden latticework that made up the medieval roof before melting its lead casing and toppling the spire. The cathedral's nave, choir, and transepts were mostly untouched by flames, thanks to the craftsmanship of the 12th and 13th century stonemasons. So were the 8,000-tube great organ and stained glass windows. However, molten lead and charred oak beams crashed through the roof, spreading embers and lead particles. Religious artifacts, paintings, and sculptures had to be rescued and cleaned. The organ and 39 stained glass windows were dismantled and washed. It took 2 years to stabilize the cathedral's stone structure. When a grave-looking President Emmanuel Macron stood outside Notre Dame on the night of the fire, he described it as the epicenter of our lives. The cathedral would be rebuilt, he vowed, within 5 years. That promise may have sounded a bit mad, concedes Philip Jost, who runs the public body in charge of the construction project, but he adds it gave everyone a clear objective. That the project is on track is also partly due to the commanding style of General Jean-Louis Georgelin, who ran it like a military operation until his death last August. A light management team, freed from bureaucratic excess, has helped too. Gifts from rich French industrialists, the Arnault, Bettencourt, and Pinault families, as well as 340,000 smaller individual donations from around the world, amounted to about $921 million. Unlike the usual grand French grand projet, this one is costing the public purse almost nothing. Today, the cramped site on the Île de la Cité, an island in the River Seine, is a veritable construction village, complete with a canteen, shower block, offices, and sculpture restoration workshop. Last summer, the first 8 triangular oak trusses, crafted for the new transit roof, arrived by river. Passersby watched in awe as one by one, each 7-ton truss was hoisted by crane from a barge and lowered into place. The craftsmen working on the project are specialist artisans drawn from dozens of small firms from around France. Rather than contract the rebuilding to one company, over 140 separate tenders were put out in order to support traditional craftsmanship. The demands were unusually high. A decision was taken to restore the cathedral to its former splendor while remaining faithful both to its original designs and the construction techniques of the time. For the roof above the medieval nave and choir, 1,200 oak logs were individually selected from forestry plantations in France and hewn by hand into square timber beams. Craftsmen used hand-forged axes based on late 12th and early 13th century models. On the curved apse roof, finished on January 12, wooden dowel pegs hold the trusses together without a single industrial metal piece. The idea was to work with tools that are as close as possible to those used in the Middle Ages, in order to give the wood the aspect of the time, says Valentin Pontarolio, a carpenter from Atelier Perrault, a firm in western France. One of the joys this brought was that there was often no machinery noise, just the sound of the axe, he says. For the artisans, completion will be poignant. Emile Armand Bruneau, an ornamental roofer on the cathedral's highest point, says they are working as quickly as possible so that the scaffolding can come down and the city can once again see the spire reaching into the sky. Halfway down, the carpenters contemplate the newly finished roof. "It's a bit heartbreaking to leave," said Pontarolio. "We never have a project like this again." We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.